Appendices 1918, number 1. Philosophical objections, raised immediately after the publication of this book, call for the addition of the following brief discussion to this new edition. I can imagine that there are readers who take an interest in the other contents of this book, but who will regard what follows as a superfluous, remote, and abstract web of concepts. They may leave this brief discussion unread. But problems crop up in a philosophical contemplation of the world that have their origin more in certain thinkers' prejudices than in the natural course of human thinking itself. Other issues treated in this book seem to me to present a task that concerns every human being who strives for clarity in regard to the essential nature of human beings and their relationship to the world. What follows, however, rather involves a problem some treatment of which is called for by certain philosophers in any discussion of the things portrayed in this book. This is because those philosophers have created for themselves certain difficulties that do not otherwise exist. If we bypass such problems completely, some people will be quick to make accusations of dilettantism and the like, and the opinion would gain ground that I have not sufficiently come to terms with viewpoints I have not discussed in the book itself. The problem to which I refer is this. There are thinkers who believe that a special difficulty arises when one seeks to understand how the soul life of another human being can affect one's own, that of the observer. They say, quote, "My conscious world is sealed off within me, My conscious world is sealed off within me, just as any another conscious world is sealed off within itself. I cannot see into another person's world of consciousness. How then can I come to know that we both inhabit the same world?" Unquote. Those who hold the world view that it is possible to infer from the conscious world the existence of an unconscious world that can never become conscious try to solve this difficulty by saying, quote, "The world that I have in my consciousness is the representation in me of a real world that I cannot consciously reach. In this real world, unknown to me, lie the causes of my conscious world. My own real being, of which I have likewise only a representation in my consciousness, also lies there. But this real world also contains the essential being of my fellow human beings. Now, what another person experiences in consciousness corresponds to a reality in that person's essential being, which is independent of this consciousness. The person's being is active in a realm that cannot become conscious, the realm of my own necessarily unconscious being. It is through that realm that a representation is created in my consciousness of what is present in a consciousness altogether independent of my conscious experience." Unquote. We can see that a hypothetical world inaccessible to conscious experience is here added to the world accessible to my consciousness. Otherwise, these philosophers believe we would be forced to assert that all the external reality I seem to have before me is only the world of my consciousness, and this would lead to the solipsistic absurdity that other people also exist only within my consciousness. This question, which has been created by some recent epistemological trends, can be clarified if we attempt to survey the matter from the viewpoint of the spiritually oriented observation described in this book. What, then, do I have before me when I face another person? I look at what is immediately apparent. It is the sensory bodily appearance of the other person, given to me as a percept, and perhaps also the auditory percept of what the person is saying, and so forth. I do not really stare at all of this. Rather, it sets my thinking activity in motion. By my standing before the other person and thinking, the percept proves to be, to some extent, transparent to the soul. When I grasp the percept through thinking, I am bound to say to myself that it is not at all what it appears to be to the external senses. By what it is directly, the sensory phenomenon reveals something else that it is indirectly. Its presentation before me is at the same time its extinguishing as a mere sense phenomenon. But what it manifests during that extinguishing compels me as a thinking being to extinguish my own thinking for the period of its activity and to replace it with its thinking. I grasp this other thinking and my own thinking as an experience, as I do with my own. I have really perceived the thinking of the other person. The immediate percept, extinguishing itself as a sensory appearance, is grasped by my thinking. And this is a process lying completely within my consciousness, which consists in my thinking being replaced by the other thinking. Through the self-extinguishing of the sensory appearance, the separation between the two spheres of consciousness is actually suspended. This is represented in my consciousness in that, in experiencing the content of the other person's consciousness, I experience my own consciousness just as little as I experience it in dreamless sleep. Just as my daytime consciousness is shut out in dreamless sleep, so is the content of my own consciousness when I perceive another person's. The illusion that this is not so persists because, first, when perceiving another person, what replaces my own content of consciousness is not unconsciousness, as in sleep, but rather the content of the other person's consciousness. And second, the oscillations between the extinction and re-illumination of my consciousness of myself follow one another too rapidly to be normally noticed. The whole problem cannot be solved by artificial conceptual constructs that infer from what is conscious other things that can never be conscious. It must be solved through true experience of what results from a union of thinking and percepts. This applies to many questions that appear in the philosophical literature. Thinkers ought to seek the path to unprejudiced, spiritually oriented observation, but instead they slide an artificial conceptual construction in front of reality. In a treatise by Edward von Hartmann, quote, Ultimate Questions in Epistemology and Metaphysics, unquote, my book is classed with philosophical works based on, quote, epistemological monism, unquote. Von Hartmann dismisses this standpoint as impossible for the following reason. According to the way of thinking he develops in his treatise, there are only three possible epistemological positions. We can remain at the naive position that takes perceived phenomena as real things outside human consciousness. In that case, we lack critical awareness. We would be unaware that the content of consciousness is, after all, only in our own consciousness. We would not see that we are dealing not with a table in itself, but only with the object of our own consciousness. Whoever remains at this standpoint, or after reflection returns to it, is a naive realist. But this point of view is untenable, precisely because it fails to see that consciousness has no access to objects outside consciousness. Alternatively, we can survey the situation and fully acknowledge it, and in this case we become transcendental idealists. As such, we have to deny that anything of the thing in itself can ever enter human consciousness. But in this way, if we are sufficiently consistent, we would be unable to escape absolute illusionism. The world confronting us would transform itself into a mere sum of objects of consciousness, indeed the objects of our own consciousness, and we would be compelled absurdly to think of other human beings as also existing only in the content of our own consciousness. Only the third position of von Hartmann's is supposed to be tenable, transcendental realism. This view assumes that there are things in themselves, but that they cannot become immediate experiences of consciousness. Things in themselves cause the objects of consciousness to appear from beyond human consciousness, but in a way that does not enter consciousness. We can arrive at things in themselves only by inference from the content of our consciousness, which, though only mental pictures, is our only kind of experience. Von Hartmann claims that an epistemological monism, which is how he describes my position, would really have to embrace one of his own three positions. He claims that such a monism fails to do so only because it does not draw the proper conclusions from its premises. He goes on to say, long quote now, if one wants to find out to which epistemological position a supposed epistemological monist belongs, one need only present him with certain questions and compel him to answer them. For on his own he will not be inclined to express himself on these points, and he will also try in every way to evade answering direct questions, because every answer nullifies epistemological monism's claim to be a standpoint distinct from the three others. These questions are as follows. 1. Are things continuous or intermittent in their existence? If the answer is continuous, then we are dealing with some form of naive realism. If the answer is intermittent, then it is transcendental idealism. But if the answer is that they are continuous on the one hand, parenthesis, as contents of absolute consciousness, or as unconscious mental pictures, or as possibilities of perception, parenthesis, and intermittent on the other hand, parenthesis, as contents of limited consciousness, parenthesis, then transcendental realism is established. 2. If three persons are sitting at a table, how many instances of the table are present? Whoever answers one is a naive realist. Whoever answers three is a transcendental idealist. But whoever answers four is a transcendental realist. Of course, this last example presupposes that we may combine under the common heading instances of the table such disparate things as the one table as thing in itself and the three tables as perceptual objects in the three consciousnesses. If this seems to be too great a freedom, he or she will give the answer one and three instead of four. 3. If two persons are alone in a room together, how many instances of those persons are present? Whoever answers two is a naive realist. Whoever answers four, namely an I and an other in each of the two consciousnesses, is a transcendental idealist. But whoever answers six, parenthesis, namely two persons as things in themselves and four persons as objects of mental picturing in the two consciousnesses, is a transcendental realist. Whoever wanted to prove that epistemological monism is a standpoint different from these three would have to give a different answer to each of these three questions, but I do not know what this could be. End of quote. The answers of intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, would have to be as follows. 1. Those who grasp only the perceptual contents of things and take it for reality are naive realists. They do not realize that those perceptual contents can be considered as persisting only as long as they are observed, and therefore that what is before us must be thought of as intermittent. But as soon as we are aware that reality is present only in thought-permeated percepts, we arrive at the insight that the perceptual content that appears as intermittent, if it is permeated by what is worked through in thinking, reveals itself to be continuous. What we must therefore consider to be continuous is the perceptual content grasped in directly experienced thinking, of which what is only perceived would have to be regarded as intermittent, if, as is not the case, it were real. 2. When three people sit at a table, how many instances of the table are present? There is only one table present. But as long as the three people want to stay with their perceptual images, they have to acknowledge that these perceptual images are in no way a reality. As soon as we switch over to the table as grasped in their thinking, the one reality of the table reveals itself to them. They are united in that reality with their three contents of consciousness. 3. If two people are alone in a room together, how many instances of them are present? There are most certainly not six, not even in the sense of transcendental realists, but only two. Yet initially both have only the unreal, perceptual image of themselves, as well as the other person. There are four of these images, and through their presence in the two people's thinking, reality is grasped. In this thinking activity, each person reaches beyond his or her own sphere of consciousness. In it, both one's own and the other person's consciousness comes to life. In the moments of its coming to life, the two people are no more enclosed within their own consciousness than they are during sleep. But at other moments, the consciousness of merging with the other reappears, so that in the experience of thinking, the consciousness of each person grasps both itself and the other person. I know that a transcendental realist would call this a relapse into naive realism. Yet, as I have already indicated in this book, naive realism retains its validity in the case of thinking that is experienced. Transcendental realists by no means experience the true state of affairs in the cognitive process. They cut themselves off from it by a web of thoughts in which they then become entangled. Nor should the monism, appearing in intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, be called epistemological. Rather, if an epithet is wanted, let it be called monism of thought. All of this was misunderstood by Edward von Hartmann. He did not engage the specifics of the presentation in my book, but claimed that I had attempted to unite Hegelian universalist panlogism with Hume's individualistic phenomenalism. In fact, intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, has nothing to do with these two standpoints that it is supposedly attempting to unite. Parenthesis, this is also why I could not, for example, enter into a discussion of Johannes Remke's epistemological monism. The viewpoint of intuitive thinking as a spiritual path, the philosophy of freedom, is completely different from what von Hartmann and others call epistemological monism. Parenthesis. End of the first addendum.